the second tape of the debrief of Colonel D.E. Lowndes, 015530 by Colonel R.H. Mample, 040489, at headquarters FMF FAC, 29 July 1968. Classification is secret.
Accounts to coincide with the seriousness of the operation at hand.
This is a classified Marine Corps thing, isn't it?
Yep.
Okay. Body count, as far as I'm concerned, is a waste of commander's time and effort and everything else. Wars are not won on body count. Wars are won by one guy beating the other guy. And the rules in my regiment were that I'd be damned if I'd be condemned for erroneously counting people that dead weren't. And my rule was that if you can't put your foot on them, forget it. Because if they... I'm the regimental commander and I'm going to do the best job I possibly can. And if my job depends on me having to dig up bodies to get a body count, it's not going to happen. And I believe, my personal views are, that the body count is overestimated and serves only the purpose of pacifying the press. Now, those are personal views, and certainly it gives the commander, I mean, the commander would like to know how many people he killed, because it gives him an idea of the size force which attacked him. In other words, you can take the, if you can count the bodies and you know that there are 50 bodies you counted, then you figure, okay, if there were 50 there and your wound ratio is 4-1, 200, if it were 200, you possibly had a battalion against you. Okay, this is an evaluation, but to count every single body, to me, it serves no real purpose, really. I mean, except it gives a commander an evaluation. And my rules were, and I presume that they were followed, at least every time I checked them, they were followed, is that unless you put your foot on that body, forget it. In other words, when somebody says to you, how many dead were there, you've got to be able to put your foot on them. None of this business of, there were 50 guys in that bunker, we hit the bunker, and therefore there's 50 dead people. But that's just the way I played the game, and I presume that most regimental commanders played it that way. But I don't know that it serves a purpose, except I suppose it keeps the press off the commander's backs at higher echelons than the regiment, really. Did I answer the question?
Yes, sir.
Any other questions?
With respect to the sensors, did you have anything at Kazan to interpret the intelligence of the sensors, or was this information gone to Thailand and then come back to you?
We did it, we had it both ways, really, at varying times. When the program started off, we were getting the readouts from Thailand, and it was taking too long. So then they put in a direct circuit between me and Thailand so that the plane would read out the sensor, send it to Thailand, and over. And it would vary. Sometimes we'd get them in, we get a readout in a minute, other times it'd be 15, 20 minutes. Then, eventually, as I remember it, we actually were getting the readout the same time the plane was getting. The plane was sending it to Thailand, but we were on the circuit and we'd get the direct readout from the plane. So that, basically, after the system was established, and of course, this was part of the process that I was talking about growing up, that as we grow up and use these things, we ought to do it ahead of time. So that when the regimental commander says, if they said to me now again, you're going to have sensors, okay, where am I going to get my readout from? And if they said Thailand, say, I go to the communicator, say, okay, I want a direct circuit from me to Thailand, or give me the frequencies of the plane that's going to read out these sensors, and I want to get on the circuit with him. I'd know that. But it took a while to learn the system and get these things. And this is what we've got to do with people. We've got to educate people so that they can use the tools of war. And these are new tools of war. Now, the only thing in justification of not having it was that there was nobody knew how this thing was going to work because it had never been used before. And we were placed in the position of being the first ones to really, really use it gainfully, I guess. I imagine the people in DOD who developed this certainly must have thought about it, but I don't know that their thinking had developed as far.
Did it get advanced to the stage where you could say you were getting real-time information? If you were getting the readout from the plane directly into your CP, then could you react on the information immediately, or was it just another bit of intelligence that went into your overall plan? For example,
both ways. Now, after you followed this thing for a while, when, for example, when I set my defenses up, I figured that there were two main avenues of approach that he would try to attack me from. And I geared my defenses to meet these two main avenues of approach, which were based on current intelligence, really, prisoners of war and other things. I based my defense on this. The sensors verified that this is what he was trying to do. Now, when I'd get a readout, I could react to the readout depending upon what I thought. Did I want to act immediately on that, or did I want to wait for it? Then, if I felt that the FSCC felt that we automatically, they'd go ahead and shoot the target. At the same time, it would go into the overall picture of what we were planning as to what, you know, as to our estimate of the enemy situation. One night, for example, I consider it really a key point, and I can't ever prove that it was, unfortunately. But the sensors started along Route 9, went fairly crazy, and they were following them. And they swung around, and we picked them up by aircraft. Now, this to me was the start of a main attack. At the same time, they started to the northwest coming in. Okay. Immediately, because of all this sensor activity, and in two directions, I figured he's off after something. Well, as it turned out, I felt very strongly about it because I felt that we had had a probe the night before. I figured that this might well be the main attack. So he started down, and he was coming in, and I called up a division, and I said, I need a B-52 strike now. Any later than 2 hours from now, forget it, because he's going to have closed with me. So I took the sensors and figured out where I thought he was going to come, and the sensors were verifying it, that he was following a general path. Then I said, here's where I want the B-52 strike, because he's going to come up, and there were two roads that led into Quezon. One went by the Frenchman's house, and the other went come in by the dump. These were the two roads that I figured that he was coming down, either the roads or the draws, but in that general area. So I ordered the B-52 strikes. And amazingly enough, and probably one of the few times, 2.5 hours later, I had figured from the sensors how fast they were moving and the course he was taking, 2.5 hours where they'd be. So 2 hours where they'd be. So the strike actually didn't come for 2.5 hours, but it came into the area where I figured they were. This was the only time that the kids on the lines told me, the Marines on the lines told me, that they saw bodies actually being thrown in the air. And I sincerely believe, and as I say, I can't prove it, I sincerely believe that those strikes caught at least two battalions. We were already in contact on the perimeter, and I believe that we were in contact with a battalion, so I feel we had a regiment. We beat this battalion, and we beat this battalion. We not only used again in the supporting arms, we not only used the B-52s, but as soon as the B-52s lifted, we called in TPQs with the A-6 and also 175s, 155. We shot everything into that target area, and we beat this battalion on the end of the airstrip, and that ended it. But this, The answer, I guess I beat around the bush, but the answer to your question is yes, we use the information both immediately and long-range intelligence-wise planning, depending upon what we at the time thought the situation was. And the information would come into the two section, go directly to the TIO, who would plot it, and then take the appropriate action on how we're going to fire on it, depending on what else was happening in the area at the time.
Colonel, you mentioned duds with the selected grenades before, the ones in the formerly co-frame. Now, that, that grenade has a higher dud rate than the standard grenade, and its dud rate is somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 7%. Would you say that the reports you had back exceeded that rate insofar as duds were concerned?
As near as I can remember, yes. The report I got from the battalion commander was that it did exceed 6 or 7%. And I can't give you a percent, but I'm sure that it was in excess of that, because he was concerned about it.
Yes, well, that was the first generation, and they weren't too good to begin with. I'm just curious to find out if they're actually worse.
Well, I would say that yes, the report I got was in excess of 67%.
Anything else?
Sir, were scout dogs used in connection with the defense of Quezon or the subsequent operations?
My experience with scout dogs over the period of my career has not been the best. Yes, the answer to your question is yes, scout dogs were used. The scout dog could not take the sustained shelling. We had one problem with a scout dog whose handler got hit and then turned on other Marines in the area, broke his chain or whatever he had on him and attacked some Marines, and they eventually shot him because he had already bitten two people.
I'm not prepared to say that the scout dog does not have a place. I say that because some battalion commanders had little faith in them, and the results that they got from them, I think, were accordingly. John Stewart, when he took over 326, had unlimited faith in scout dogs, and I think he utilized them, and I think he worked them real well, and I think he got real good results. Basically, when we were under the heavier shelling, the dogs just couldn't adapt themselves to it and were taken to the rear. And they were left there for some time, but eventually they started back in, and as I say, 326 used them to good advantage. Prior to that time, they had been used and were used on a regular basis, not only as not only scout dogs, but what do they call them, sentry dogs? The sentry dogs, and I really don't know. I mean, my personal opinion is that the dog has limitations, but who doesn't, including human beings? And I say, I think if you've got the confidence and they're used properly, there probably is a place. Certainly, I think I could say myself that in a defensive posture that the dog is of little value to you. However, in offensive posture, certainly they serve a purpose. I had experience with dogs in World War II, and it was unfavorable at that time, and simply because of the limitations, maybe I wasn't ready to accept the fact that that they have a limited capability, the same as everybody. I mean, we have our shortcomings. And I think particularly for ambushes and things like that, the dog probably is a pretty good advantage because they do alert. No question about that. I haven't helped you a bit. My feelings are mixed, really, personally.
Sir, I was wondering about your incoming. Was there any significant trends toward your own artillery and your counter battery? Was it effective, or did they get many of your own artillery?
I think that we were amazingly either they were amazingly inaccurate or we were amazingly lucky. But we lost very few pieces. We lost the 155, but it was sitting on the airstrip right in the open waiting to be evacuated. We had a couple guns go down at one time or other. The crews were, every now and then, would get dinged with shrapnel. The big thing that we lost was tires. Man, tires like they were going out of style because of the shrapnel. But the artillery pieces were amazingly adorable, and I don't know of any real time that they really concentrated on artillery. I never did figure out why. One battery they had pretty well under pressure, but I don't think it was the battery that they were shooting at. They were shooting at the old ammo dump that they had blown up on the first day. And I think they were shooting for that again, and this artillery unit happened to be near it, and they would catch it now and then. But I can't remember the figures, but they were phenomenally low for what you would think. We should have. I mean, I figured, I had said beforehand, and I told the artillery people, you get dug in because this battle will be won or lost if with artillery. In other words, if I lose my artillery before he loses his, I'm in trouble. And you guys got to stay in business, so dig deep. And when the battle actually was fought, my artillery stood up real well. I don't know how his stood up. It'd be interesting to know. All I know is, and it's pretty interesting, that maybe there's two things I could add, just that in the breeze here, but we had probably as many AOs when they really got serious about this thing. We probably had as many AOs as we'd have AOs up day and night. We knew basically from our observations where this artillery was coming from, crater analysis and everything else. We did the whole bit like you should, and we knew basically where that artillery was coming from. We'd put AOs over. If we started getting artillery, we'd switch our AOs down to that area. When it got particularly bad, and we figured he'd start at night, which is unusual because, as you well know, generally they won't shoot at night for fear of giving away with the flashes. But we put the AOs over there, sometimes as many as three at a time. We'd have three AOs circling this suspected area. We'd still get the incoming, and on only one occasion do I know that the AOs were able. A Marine AO went down there, I forget his name, a real fine boy, and he went down there and he got four or five pieces. But basically, we had a problem detecting where the heck we were getting. We could get the rockets all right. The rockets we could find. It was the artillery we had trouble locating. They brought in 37 guns and put them just below town of Caisson, and we caught them going into position, and this saved us a lot of problem. We did detect them. Had they got into position first, I don't know whether we made out. Actually, the AO did a good job. He spotted them digging in placements one day. The next day, he caught the guns going in position, and boy, we took out about 8 or 10 in one day, just right out of circulation. So we need, and I suppose I'm a dreamer, but what we really need, we spend millions of dollars in the space program, and yet we go on, and I've gone through this now in World War II and Vietnam and Korea. We spend, we've gone through this every time. I don't think it's a new problem. I think this is a problem that's been with us maybe since World War I don't know. I wasn't in World War I. I feel that old sometimes. But we haven't been able to detect artillery. What we need, and I don't know how much money it costs, what we need is to take all of this technology we got, sensors and acoustical devices and everything, we need to put it on a thing, and we need to put a computer on the back of it and mount it on a 175 or a 155 and let the round come in, and the thing picks it up, puts a dot on the gun, and fires the gun back. Maybe this is daydreaming. But we've gone so long now that, and it's not new. It wasn't, I don't consider it unique to me. They have the same problem up
around Khon Chen and everything, locating the damn things. And of course, it was harder where we were because of the nature of the terrain and the vegetation around it.
Colonel, regarding sensors, there were a lot of them employed. Which do you feel was most effective in detecting tunneling?
I don't know. And the reason I don't know, I think, is because contrary to most of the things you read in the paper, I don't think he ever tried to tunnel a case on Combat Base. In other words, afterwards we went out and we searched, we couldn't find any place he was trying to tunnel. He was digging trenches, and he might have a tunnel from a bunker to another bunker somewhere south of the base there. But as far as I know, there were, I could find no efforts to tunnel. And if anybody wants it, I probably got, I bet you I got 30 letters or 50 letters from people all over the world telling me how to detect tunneling. One thing I think, if you're interested in that thing, is that one you might check out that seems of real interest to me is that some guy wrote me from São Paulo, Brazil. And I can give you his name. His name is Townsend. I still remember. And he said that he went from the States, evidently he's American, has a son who was a corpsman in Vietnam. He said when he went to South America, they have some kind of bug that attacks the base of whatever he's growing. I can't remember what he grows. But that this device that he has, and he gave me the name, as a matter of fact, I got it in my briefcase over there, I'm pretty sure. May or may not have. Anyway, he said this thing will detect these little bugs burrowing around in the soil. Now, if it's that sensitive, and it's a commercial product, if it's that sensitive, then, boy, that seems to me to be the answer. But I've got, we tried everything. I'll be honest, we tried everything. We tried listening with posts and stethoscopes, and partly because we were really interested in it, and partly because it was a morale factor as far as I'm concerned. The kids knocked themselves out just thinking about it. We were more worried about tunnels than they were about artillery shells coming in, which was good. But all kinds of divining rods and everything, and the divining rods finally located where the tunnel was coming in, and I think they're still digging. No, they left the basin. But the last I knew, they were still digging. They were down about 60 feet, and they'd hit nothing yet. But there were no entrances leading under the base. So to give you an evaluation, we tried everything, and what. The only one I'm sure didn't work was a divining rod because they dug down so many times, but this guy was sure that he had a tunnel and there was no tunnel there. But I can't give you an evaluation because as far as I know, there were no tunnels under the base. None whatsoever. Nor any attempt to come under the base. And it would have been difficult to tunnel under because right, as you may remember, right around the base sat on a plateau, which meant that they had to start at the base of the plateau where we were fairly regularly getting out, or they had to start on a hill line before, and they had to go so deep to get under the gully that, they had gone practically to China to get under there. But I, the answer to your question is that I know of no case where tunneling was, and therefore none of our detection devices worked because there was nothing to work on.
Why, in your opinion, did the designation from the time to fill up the words? I always felt that would be one of the first indications that they were getting ready to make the
pose
and squeeze
play. I don't know whether he recognized. You see, the thing is that he didn't have to come to the water point to cut off my water supply. I mean, I don't think he could have done that. He couldn't have cut it off at my supply point. The terrain was just too much in my advantage. I mean, this would have been, he might have gone down there at night and blew the dam we had made, but even then we'd have got enough water simply from the stream flowing by that there would have been no problem. He could have polluted the water above where he wouldn't even come under our observation. This would have been possible. I suppose The only thing I can think of is that he didn't really realize that we were counting on that. I mean, this is the only reason that I could possibly think in my mind. Let me say that it caused both General Tompkins and myself a lot of concern as to what we were going to do if he polluted that water up, because I had been told that there was no water at a reasonable depth within the combat base itself. In other words, that we could have drilled for. They had had a geologist up there, and he had looked into it. So the only alternate solution then would have been, of course, to fly it in, which would have compounded our logistic problem about 100%. He did a couple times get within rocket range, and he hit the bladders that we stored our water in. But this only limited, we kept the water cans full at all times, so this just meant a matter of repairing it, and he hit the water pump once, and this was a matter of stealing one from the MAC-2 and using it. But the reason maybe he just didn't realize the importance of that water supply to us.
Chuck?
Operation
Pegasus in
retrospect,
Colonel.
Are there any comments you may care to make relative to the scheme or its execution?
No, I don't really think that I have any comments. The scheme was to open Route 9. At that particular time, as you may well realized if you followed it, the enemy had about between the 12th and the 20th, I'd say, of March, had already started to withdraw his forces back. Realizing, I'm guessing again because I don't know, but he had taken a pretty good pounding, and so he had already started to withdraw as a 1-9 busted out of the perimeter and got down to the hill down just overlooking Quezon with no problem. And as you know, the first air cav came in and came hippity-hopping down Route 9, and they bumped into very little till they got near Quezon and had no major problems. So that I really have no comments. I mean, it wasn't, let's put it this way, as far as I'm concerned, it wasn't a necessity for the survival of Quezon by a long shot. I mean, I had been there 9 months, and I could have stayed 9 more months if they'd have wanted to, as long as they kept resupplying me. And the air was working real fine. So really, Route 9 played no importance to me. It might have played some importance politically to people, the fact that it could be open, but played no importance.
Well, Colonel Lowndes, on behalf of these gentlemen gathered here and FMF PAC, thanks very much for a very informative briefing, and the best of luck to you at Disneyland East.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.